yourselves.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Should non-citizens in America be allowed to vote and hold office in American cities and then get away with it? Now, if you say, well, Lars, where is that happening? I plan to tell you exactly where it's happening. But first, I want to welcome you to the great conversation on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you happen to be a naysayer, we love naysayers on this show. Naysayers go right to the head of the line. Just be prepared to make your best argument and then stick around for a few questions from me. And it usually works out better. I will answer anything you want. You have to answer anything I ask, and I think that's reasonable. But you know the number. If you want to send an email instead, talk@LarsLarson.com. And our X poll today. Now, this one's kind of funny because one of my producers, Mackenzie, she saw this and she said, do you like the X poll question? Sometimes she writes them, sometimes I do. And I said, I absolutely love it. Listen carefully. Is it now embarrassing for women to have boyfriends? And if you say, well, Lars, who gave you that crazy idea? Let me tell you where it came from. The Daily Mail is reporting about a rather major women's magazine known as Vogue. Vogue now says that women in today's society are now embarrassed to have boyfriends. According to Vogue, having a man in your life is seen as cringe and culturally loserish. And that is prompting women to hide evidence of their boyfriends on social media. A piece written by Shantae Joseph explores the many different reasons why women want to keep their romance secret, as she admitted to muting her own contacts and social media posts as soon as they mention a boyfriend. In fact, one influencer, Stephanie Yeboa, admitted she'd lost hundreds of followers when she said, I've got a relationship. Yeah, another interview, he said she never shared her 12-year relationship with her boyfriend and feels vindicated since they recently split up. And she doesn't have to live with a digital public record of their relationship. And here's the keeper. Why does having a boyfriend make you feel like a Republican? Now, I understand it's coming from a fairly liberal magazine, and that's Vogue. I'll give them proper credit. But is it possibly because it might suggest that you're on a path to someday become, oh, the horror, a trad wife? Yep. I think that's exactly what's going on. Is it now embarrassing for women to have boyfriends? I'd say no to that. But then I'm an old traditional guy, and I have a trad wife, by the way. Although I don't know if Tina would like that. In any case, you can find the question at Lars Larson Show and on our website at LarsLarson.com. Let me get back to the non-citizen who holds a public office and has for the last almost 5 years in Kansas. In a small town in Kansas, he is the mayor. In fact, he was just reelected on Tuesday night, except that now he's facing a criminal investigation because he was reelected Tuesday night in the election as the mayor of Coldwater, Kansas. He's now been charged with 3 counts of voting without being qualified, meaning he's a non-citizen, and 3 counts of election perjury. Both of those are felonies. Let me tell you why I think this is especially relevant in Oregon and Washington, because both Oregon and Washington have found that we have thousands of non-citizens who are registered to vote. As far as I can tell, we don't have any non-citizens who hold elective office in the Northwest, but I guess that's the next step. If you're willing to vote illegally, would you be willing to hold office illegally? And of course, the officials in Oregon and Washington are not willing to use the tools that Kansas used to find those illegal voters, and in this case, apparently an alleged illegal office holder. But let me tell you what's happening in Kansas right now. The attorney general of that state, Chris Kobach, he's been on this show before, and he's a good guy. He actually says the current system is kind of like the honor system.
In large part, our system right now is based on trust. Trust that when the person signs the registration or signs the poll books saying that he's a qualified elector or that he is a United States citizen, that the person is telling the truth.
Yeah, it's the honor system, and it sounds like it's very easy to cheat. Kobach says they are currently going through all the registered voters, about 2 million of them in the state of Kansas, and they expect to find literally hundreds of people on the voter rolls who are not legally eligible to vote. And I know they suggest that, well, it's just a small number. I'll tell you what, how many of the elections have you seen? Because I've seen a bunch of them where a couple of hundred votes made all the difference in the world. In fact, a couple of hundred votes made all the difference between getting stuck with Al Gore as president of the United States. George Bush was better, although I'm not exactly his biggest fan these days. But there are plenty of elections that are decided by a couple of hundred votes. And TV News, in Kansas at least, is having a field day with the story.
The mayor of Coldwater accused of election fraud. The charges come hours after he secured a second term in office. Attorney General Chris Kobach charged Mayor Jose Joe Ceballos with six felonies, three counts each of voting without being qualified and election perjury.
Now, I want to make it clear, Joe Ceballos is a Mexican national. He is living legally in the United States. They didn't go to the detail of whether or not he has a green card or whether or not he sought refugee or asylum status. He is now looking at 68 months in prison, almost 6 years, and up to $200,000 in fines. And I know one little thing, because I used to have a legal resident alien green card holder as one of my producers. And she would tell me time and again, I know that if I commit a crime, a serious crime, like a felony crime, they can take away my green card and send me back home. Let me go back to the news story about the indictment in Kansas.
Kobach claims Ceballos is lawfully living in the U.S., but is a citizen of Mexico, making him ineligible to vote. The AG alleges the mayor illegally cast ballots in the August 2024 primary and November 2022 and 2023 general elections.
Now, not only did he do that, but he ran for mayor 4 years ago, got elected last Tuesday, got reelected, and the problem is, in most states, you have to be a U.S. citizen to vote, and you have to be a qualified voter to be able to seek office. Now, there are 26 states in America right now who are using a database. The database is called the Systemic Alien Verification for Entitlements, the SAVE database. And what they do is they find out, are you a citizen or are you not? They can check your SNAP benefits, your TANF, they can check your Section 8, they can check all those various benefits, and they can find out if you're legally eligible to vote. 26 different states are now using the database to verify voter registration. And if you say 26, Lars, but there are 50 states. That's right, 24 of them are the kind of blue Democrat states that have decided, don't ask, don't tell. We don't want to know if you're not legally in the country. We don't want to know if you're voting illegally. And apparently, at least in the state of Kansas, we don't want to know if you illegally ran and served as mayor and got reelected as mayor. We just don't want to know. So it's going to be a don't ask, don't tell kind of situation in half of America. But in more than half the states, they're checking. And it sounds like some people are going to have to get prepared to go back home because they broke America's laws. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. The Northwest Nonsense is coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho.
Best investment in talk radio, and it's free. Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, remember that famous movie line, if you build it, they will come? Now, consider the implications of that line if you build a massive homeless industrial complex. In the last 2 years, foolish governments in the Tri-County Portland metro area spent about $1.5 billion on what they euphemistically call homeless services. The Seattle and the Puget Sound area are not much different. And much of that money didn't actually make its way to the so-called homeless. It went into six-figure salaries. I'm not kidding. Some of these NGO CEOs are making, they're making $200,000, $300,000 a year. You say, CEO of a private nonprofit that serves the homeless is making a quarter mil? Yep, absolutely right. And guess what? The homeless have flocked to the area in droves. Now, some of us have been warning about this for years. When I was a little kid and I lived with my park ranger dad at Mount Rainier National Park, they always warned us, don't feed the bears unless you want to get a whole lot more bears. In those same 2 years of shoveling out taxpayer cash by the hundreds of millions, the homeless population of the Portland Metro has soared 61%, according to the count just released this week. Do you see the connection? A lot of those mostly drug-addicted and often crazy concrete campers have come from all over America to live in the Pacific Northwest. And why would they seek out the Northwest? Easy benefits, free tents and tarps, effectively legalized hard drugs and weed, and a complacent government that rarely rousts them out. Only now, the businesses and the people who pay the taxes to fund this insane social experiment, they're heading for the door. And what are you going to do when you run out of that money? Glad to have you with me on a Thursday. We call this Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And as always, naysayers go first. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and you get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Is the Daily Dead fish wrapper, in this case Oregon Live, not the Times, is it now only good for wrapping trash and not even fish? John writes in, Lars, under its new leader, Laura Gunderson, the Oregonians' bias in favor of immigrants, local government, and ICE protesters continues. Protesters are mainly portrayed as noble and whimsical heroes, illegals as oppressed, innocent community members. Local and state authorities are righteous public servants, and federal agents are brutal thugs. In what world does that fly as professional journalism? Not my world, signed John. And my favorite post on X, this one came in from Dagny Taggart on social media. Lars, with the price of food and rent and everything else, many families are struggling to make ends meet. And yet they want us, the families already struggling, to support the families who will not work. K2 interviewed a man the other day who said how hard it was having his SNAP benefits gone because he's responsible for supporting his kids. But the truth is, we're supporting his kids, not him. Why didn't anybody point that out? The government will continue to take from those who have to give to those who don't until no one has anything left and we all rely on the government. I firmly believe that this is their aim, because then we would truly be a socialist country. Thanks for all the hard work, signed Dagny Taggart. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves is Lars' Grill of the Day.
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to all the cartel news media for driving fear and panic almost every day for the last 2 weeks. I've seen headlines that talk about school districts that are closing down their perimeters, and city councils and county commissions all over the Northwest who are holding public hearings at which they hear from people who say, we're completely afraid. And what are they afraid of? Law enforcement? That somebody might come to your community and actually enforce the laws of the United States? Yeah. And the news media buys into it 100% hook, line, and sinker. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I hired them to do it for me, and it's beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or call 855-CAP-THAT. Jim writes, and Lars, last week I dropped off one of my steel chainsaws at the local A store and decided to buy a smaller saw as a backup. Last week I bought it for $199. Then I went to the store yesterday. The price going forward is $249. Last week when I talked to the manager, he said they'd received from management a cost increase on 2,000 items in his store, but they had not passed that on to customers. Looks like it's happening now on thousands of little items. I believe in tariffs to protect American sawmills against Canada, as Canada subsidizes their sawmills to get cheaper logs. But tariffs on everything, including essential daily goods, is really in the process of doing harm. Maybe Trump should send the tariff money back to the people as a stimulus check. He should relax on many small items, but still protect our big industries, signed Jim. Hear calls now at 866-439-5277. Let me go to Susie first. Hey, Susie, welcome to the program. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday. What's on your mind?
About both sides of the shutdown, and I know that you're really on top of all that. So
I try.
I'm hoping you could clarify for me. The Democrats say that really what all they want is an extension of the health care subsidies, and that if the Republicans would agree to that, then they would vote to end the shutdown. But the Republicans are saying that the Democrats want free health care for everybody. And I don't know where that's coming from, because with the Democrats, it's already law that immigrants, undocumented people, cannot get health care except the emergency. And it's documented. You can find it. But what the Republicans are saying that they want, I can't find any documentation.
Okay, I've got it for you. Susie, I've got it for you. Yeah. If you send me an email, and I'll be glad to tell you where to find it in case somebody says, well, don't trust that, Lars. Let me tell you what's gone on. The one big, beautiful bill, the extension of the tax cuts that passed July 4th of this summer. So it's months ago now.
Right.
That bill said explicitly, you will not pay Medicaid or Medicare or any of those other benefits for illegal aliens. Now, I'll get to the Obamacare subsidies in a moment. But on the illegal aliens, what have the Democrats done? I'm going to take them at their word. There is a document they've filed. I think it's a couple of hundred pages long. But on page 57, as pointed out by House Speaker Mike Johnson, and I've got a copy of the document. I'll send you the link so you can say, well, where did this link come from? From a government website run by the United States government. In it, the Democrats say we want to eliminate the parts of that bill, the law that passed this summer that says illegal aliens can't have Medicaid and can't have Medicare either if they're of that age. So the Democrats in writing have asked that illegal aliens have their health care paid for. That is about $200 billion in the current budget that they want added back to the current budget and to cover illegal aliens. So they've asked for it in writing.
I just wanted to know what the documentation was because I couldn't find it.
Okay,
I understand the argument.
This is not just you, Susie. It's everybody listening. I want everybody to understand. It's in writing. The Democrats put it in writing. Their proposed continuing resolution adds hundreds of billions of dollars to Obamacare subsidies, and it covers illegal aliens from Medicaid, and it's in writing.
The Lars Larson Show. No need to adjust your volume. He's just that loud. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. We all know the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and getting expecting different results. Now imagine if that same thing that you did over and over again, not just for a little while, but for, say, half a century. And let's assume that it cost you $1.8 trillion over the last half century, and you got worse results than you got at the very beginning of that. Would that make any sense to anyone? Now, I've described transit in America and the federal funding of it. Randall O'Toole is a Thoreau Institute policy analyst and a Cascade Policy Institute adjunct scholar. He's author of 6 books, including Gridlock, Why We're Stuck in Traffic and What to Do About It. He's one of the top transportation experts in the United States. Randall, welcome back to the program.
I am glad to be here.
Now, you made that estimate. You said we've spent $1.8 trillion in half a century as a country on transit, and transit has fewer people per capita riding it today than it did half a century ago. Have I misstated any of that?
Well, that was actually since 1991.
Oh, 30
years. The federal government started, that's just 45 years, not quite half a century, or 35 years. But the federal government started subsidizing transit in 1965. And since then, total subsidies to transit are about $2.5 trillion. And the annual subsidies have increased by 500%. The annual cost have increased by 500%. The number of people working for transit agencies have tripled. And yet the ridership is just about the same as it was in 1965. In fact, it's a little bit lower than it was in 1965. So we're carrying fewer riders. We're hiring three times as many people to do it. We're spending five times as much money. Bureaucratic overhead has gone up by even more. And we're not getting any results. Per capita ridership, as you say, has fallen by more than 50%. But just the total ridership is lower than it was back then.
Hold on. Because I assume this is all per capita, where you say, well, but Lars, we have a lot more people today than we had back in 1965 or in 1991. But I was assuming that that was a per capita comparison. It's actually fewer people riding transit overall in gross numbers, even though the country is a whole lot bigger in population than it was back then?
Well, transit mainly serves urban areas, and urban populations have doubled since then. But in 1965, transit carried about 8.25 billion riders, and last year it carried 7.75 billion riders. So 7.75 is less than 8.25. So about 7% fewer total riders, and we're spending, you know, five times as much money to carry that smaller number of riders.
I mean, you've suggested this, if this were an athletic competition, then mass transit would earn either a bronze, silver, or maybe even a gold medal for one of the worst federal investments, so-called, over the last half century. It's a bad situation. Do the people within the bureaucracies, like the U.S. Department of Transportation or the various federal agencies, do they know the numbers are that bad?
Oh, I got all my numbers from them. They are fully aware of all those numbers, but they just think, well, we just have to work a little bit harder and subsidize it a little bit more, and pretty soon people will be flocking to ride mass transit. The problem is, you can reach three times as many jobs in a typical urban area in a 20-minute auto drive as you can in a 60-minute transit ride. In any urban area in the country, you can reach all the jobs in the urban area, even New York and Los Angeles. You can reach every single job in that urban area in a one-hour auto drive, the typical resident of those urban areas.
Okay, so that means
7%. You can only reach 7% by mass transit.
Well, so that means that the person who might most need the help, somebody who's working in at low wages, they don't have, you know, so you assume that they might be riding transit, that you've economically strapped them down. Because if you say, you know, the person who's already established as a lawyer in a big city, or a doctor or an accountant or an engineer, they might be able to say, well, I live where I want and I take transit because it's easier than driving or parking or whatever. But the person who needs the opportunity to find that new job or the better job or the bigger paycheck, they're the ones who are strapped down if they have to rely on transit, whereas they'd be freed if they were able to drive a car, so they've chosen to drive cars. Do you think that's a reasonable analysis?
That's exactly right. And only 5% of low-income people ride transit to work. It's not like transit is made up entirely of poor people and all poor people ride transit. 5% ride transit to work. About 70% drive to work. In fact, more people who don't have cars drive alone to work. Even though they don't have a car, they drive alone to work than ride mass transit. Now, how can that be? Well, they're driving cars supplied by their employers. Maybe they're electricians or plumbers or something like that. So their employer supplies them with a truck, and they drive it home at the end of the day, and they drive to work the next day. So they know, everybody knows, you can reach everywhere better by car than you can by transit, but we throw billions of dollars at transit. We're spending more subsidies on transit than on highways. I think we could end all subsidies, but the subsidies of transit are more than highways, even though the highways carry 100 times as many passenger miles and infinitely more freight than transit.
Well, in fact, Randall, you've suggested, and I don't want to get too far on my skis on this one, but would it make sense if tomorrow we could shut down the major transit systems in America and say, if we're going to spend money on this to try to get people where they need to go, we'd be better off subsidizing Uber and Lyft and other ride services that go point to point, door to door, than we would be plowing it into giant bureaucracies and trains and buses?
Well, that would be one alternative. But I think that the subsidies we give to transit actually make transit agencies behave worse. Right now, about 95% of the money going to transit agencies comes from taxpayers and appropriated to them by politicians. So the transit agencies have no incentive to try to attract new riders. They only get a few bucks from the new riders. They get hundreds, thousands, millions, billions of dollars from the politicians. So instead, they're pleasing the politicians. And COVID taught them that if ridership plummets, they get more subsidies. Congress gave them huge subsidies to deal with COVID, and now the states are giving them subsidies to make up for lost revenues because ridership has only recovered to about 60 to 80% of what it was before COVID. So they're getting more subsidies to make up for the lost revenues from fares. So I think the thing to do is not shut down transit, just end the subsidies and let the transit agencies, or privatize them, transit companies, figure out where they can make money. And if there's a demand for it, we'll have transit.
And if there's not a demand for it, it'll go away and it'll right-size itself because the economics will force it to right-size itself.
That's right. And there will be a demand for it in some places, inner cities and things like that. There won't be a demand for it out in the suburbs. There won't be a demand for it out in rural areas. I mean, I live in a rural part of Bend, Oregon, of Deschutes County, Oregon, but I'm only a little way from a transit stop. Central Oregon has its own transit system. You know, that's just ridiculous. There's no reason to have transit out in rural areas.
No, there isn't. That's Randall O'Toole. Randall is a Thoreau Institute policy analyst and an expert on transit nationwide. Big cities hire him to come out and tell them how to get this fixed. He's also the author of 6 books, including Gridlock, Why We're Stuck in Traffic and What to Do About It. Now, I'm willing to hear from any transit fans out there, but imagine this, $1.8 trillion in the last 35 years, and transit ridership is lower in gross numbers today than it was half a century ago. You're listening to the Lawrence Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
When he talks, you have no choice but to listen. More with Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Terry writes in by email, talk@larslarson.com. Lars, since the Democrats refuse to vote to reopen the government, are they considered to be on strike? And if so, can we get scabs to go in and work in their place? Or do we just consider them no call, no show and let them go? I mean, they are refusing to work. Signed, Terry. Glad to have you with me. Glad to take your calls. And this segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Our poll on X today, as strange as it sounds to say it, is it now embarrassing for women to admit they have a boyfriend? I would say that, no, it shouldn't be. But apparently Vogue has decided that there are a lot of women out there hiding the fact that they have a boyfriend because they find admitting that they have a boyfriend to be embarrassing. And these are adult women, not girls in middle school. And they say, why does having a boyfriend feel Republican? Maybe because it connotes the path to a trad wife status. In any case, the poll on X is found at Lars Larson Show and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let me go to our first naysayer of the day, and that's John. Hey, John, welcome to the program. You know we love naysayers. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Well, I think you didn't cover the main disincentive for riding public transportation. And my first, you have a car, correct?
Yes. I have a pickup.
Would you ever consider you driving that car without insurance?
No. I think that'd be foolish.
Okay, well, there's the first. Did you know you basically...
I still don't understand what we disagree about. What do you...
Well, here, I'm going to tell you. You haven't mentioned... We disagree about the reason people aren't riding public transportation. I'm going to tell you because I think you've missed the point on it. When you travel to public transportation, you're traveling bare because none of those TriMet buses, say in Portland, have any insurance on them. If you get injured on a bus, stabbed on a bus, get thrown around by a driver, you've got no insurance coming.
They're effectively self-insured, John, because you can sue the transit agency, and TriMet has been sued any number of times. So what are you ignoring?
Yeah, look how they fight you over it. But I mean, while you're suing...
Wouldn't you expect them to fight?
Look, if I was injured in your car, say you went over, ran into a tree or something, I could get immediate medical treatment from your PIP coverage, correct?
You would get immediate medical treatment because that's what the hospital is required to do for you, even if you have no insurance. So, yes,
well,
eventually the hospital would recover the money, but the medical treatment you get is not dependent on that. If they bring you into the emergency room all busted up from a car accident, they're going to save your life. And they don't say, oh, by the way, can you afford to pay for it? Is somebody going to take it? In fact, I'd point out your comment is kind of ridiculous because how would they, when somebody is brought into a hospital emergency room from an MVA, how do they know whether either
physical therapy for years after your injury. Now, okay. They're not going to cover you.
Missed the point. John, can I tell you why I think you've missed the point? The point is not why people don't ride transit. The point is, after 50 years and $2.5 trillion, fewer people ride transit than in 1965 when the country had a lot fewer people. But I appreciate the call. Let's go to Alma in Kenmore. Alma, you are one of my best naysayers, but you're not one today.
I'm kind of a naysayer today. I really can understand how you, as a great person, can keep saying the Democrats, the Republicans are the one. If they start negotiating with the Democrats, we can get something done. If they drop the ball, my health care is going to be going up to, wow.
No, hold on, Alma, unless you're a very wealthy person, the Obamacare expansion of subsidies is going mostly to people who make a lot more money. But you've mixed two things in there together. Number one, the Republicans came to the Democrats and said, here's a clean CR, meaning a status quo budget. It doesn't go up. It doesn't go down. It's the same situation we were in 45 days ago when the government was still operating. And the Democrats have said, no, we want a whole bunch of stuff. And they made a list, and their list is $1.5 trillion long. So when you say they need to negotiate, what is it the Republicans are supposed to negotiate when they haven't asked for anything? They just said, let's run the government at the same level it's at now. And the Democrats have said, no, give us $1.5 trillion of new spending.
Lars, I don't know exactly the date, the time. Democrats only asking for help for the lower class people.
No, that is not true, Alma. The expansion of Obamacare. Let me finish, Alma, and I want you to listen to this. The expansion of Obamacare subsidies during the pandemic expanded it to the point where there were families with 500,000 household income who are getting increased subsidies because the government, in its infinite wisdom under President Autopen, decided we had to have it. But they also agreed, and it goes out of existence on New Year's Eve of 2025, which is coming up less than 2 months from now. Why should we continue that expansion at the cost of about a third of $1 trillion it was maybe necessary during the pandemic. Why should we expand it past December 31?
Because see, we don't really know the ins and outs of that new bill or new.
Well, I do.
They're gonna do. We don't know. So
we know what has been in place for the last 3 years, and we know the Democrats want to extend it. So why should we extend it?
Republicans are on vacation, Lars. You know that.
They're not on vacation. They have offered the Democrats a done deal, and all the Democrats have to do is say yes. And in this case, NorthSense.org.
Ready for the big show? In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get to your phone calls in a moment. You know, losing a limb on the streets for the homeless is becoming routine thanks to opioids laced with a horse tranquilizer. Should that crisis be treated as a public health disaster? Well, yeah, I think it should. And in fact, there's a way to go after this problem, but I don't think the authorities, at least here in the Pacific Northwest, are willing to go after it. I thought we'd talk about it with Kevin Dahlgren, who's an independent journalist reporting on homelessness, addiction, and the homeless industrial complex, which I took on today. Kevin, I get so mad at this that we have spent so much money and the number of homeless has actually gone up, and you've pointed out the same kind of thing. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Lars. And I'm just as infuriated. I mean, a 61% increase in homelessness in 2 years with record budget. I mean, it's just obscene. It's ridiculous, right?
Well,
I mean,
fact,
this is.
Do you think there's any way that the folks in charge could say, if we've spent $1.5 billion on this problem in 2 years, $750 million a year for 2 years, and the numbers have gone up 60%. Clearly, we're not making the situation better, number one, and we may be making it worse by the way we're spending that money. And I would argue that that's one of the draws for people, because you're finding 40 or 50% of the people who are here in the Northwest, in Seattle or Portland or other cities in the Northwest, they're saying, yeah, I came here from Colorado, or I came here from, I mean, name the state in America. They've come from almost everywhere. And you say, well, why would they come here? Because easy, low level, no barrier, we'll give you whatever it is you want. In fact, we'll give you more than what you want. You can throw some of it away and you can go out and behave any way you want. And drugs are relatively easy. The climate, well, it's not Southern California, but it's also not North Dakota. So it's kind of a happy medium, and stuff is free and easy. Am I wrong in drawing that conclusion, that that's what's drawing the homeless to the region?
You are not. Portland is very alluring to many, many homeless around the country. I mean, I meet homeless every single day who were out of state transplants that were given a one-way bus ticket to our city. And oftentimes it's a dump job from some small community around the country saying, go to Portland because we don't want to deal with you. There's an open air drug scene. You're not going to get arrested for anything. You can basically do what you want. And that's very appealing to a person who's not really interested in following any sort of rules. And, you know, that's the problem. And, you know, the newest study said 27% of our homeless population are out of state transplants. It's actually closer to 50. I'm glad they finally got it to double digits, because for many decades, Portland has denied that any of our homeless population are out of state, when it's really, realistically, 40 to 50%.
Well, I think even the NBC affiliate a couple of years ago that went out and did their own, you know, study, as it were, and they went around and talked to people, and they came up with 40%. And then they announced it like it was good news. Hey, it's only 40%. It's less than half that are coming. But some of that, Kevin, doesn't it come down to how you define, did you come here from somewhere else? Well, almost everybody in the region came here from somewhere else at some point. The question is, have you lived here for a couple of months, 6 months, a year,
exactly,
2 years, 5 years, or whatever? And depending on where you set that number, you say, yeah, anybody who's been here for a year, they're considered a local. They didn't come from somewhere else, even if they did. So all you've got to do is change the definition of how you define,
yep,
did you come here, and they can change the number.
Lars, you just get it. Here's the thing about the newest playing time count, because I've participated in about 10 of them. It's how you ask the question. The question is, are you a resident of Oregon? Now, anyone who cross, you know, is an immediate legal resident the moment you walk across that border.
Yep.
What they should ask is, where were you living a month ago? Where were you living a year ago? Were you born in Portland? They're not asking the right questions. And that's why the numbers are misleading, and why I absolutely do not trust that data ever.
I mean, Kevin, a few years ago, I had a friend who asked me, well, what do I have to do to get an Oregon driver's license? I said, I looked it up. You have to come to the state and say you plan to live here. You say, well, plan for how long? Just says you plan to live here. Yeah, I plan to stay. Now, you can change your plans in a week. You can change your plans in a month. But if you plan to live here at this very moment, you can get an Oregon driver's license if you define that as saying this is where I'm from.
Yeah, and you have to ask, why are they doing this? I mean, you know, obviously, this was a boon to the homeless industrial complex. This is a multi-billion-dollar industry now. And why would they work themselves out of a job? And now with a 61% increase, you just know they're going to start asking for probably $200 million more to finally, once and for all, end this crisis. I say that sarcastically because I've been hearing this for 30 years. But, like, you know, it's big money. Why would they work themselves out of a job? For them, this is a windfall.
By the way, Kevin, I want you to tell my audience about what's costing people an arm and a leg, literally. And you're right in people saying, well, it's probably frostbite. Well, if you were homeless in North Dakota or Minnesota, maybe, but not in the Pacific Northwest, unless you're up on Mount Hood and you're homeless at Timberline Lodge. And I don't think there's anybody sleeping outside there. You've tagged it to a particular kind of drug. What is it? Xylazine?
Yep. Yeah, it's called xylazine. The street name is called Trank. It is a horse tranquilizer. It is added to fentanyl, which is already the most deadliest substance in history. And when you combine the two, it's leading to this epidemic of amputations on the streets. Every day I find homeless people where I can see their bone. Their skin is literally melting off of them because that is the side effect of this horse tranquilizer. And because fentanyl is king on the streets, 90%+ are actively using one of the deadliest, strongest drugs in history. I wrote this because I'm trying to raise awareness that, like, maybe once and for all, people can treat this like the real crisis it is. And maybe what it takes is for people to realize that people's limbs are literally falling off on the streets. That, to me, qualifies as a crisis, right? I mean, it's kind of obscene what I have to write about to get people to notice in the social service system or say, our elected officials. Not all of them. You know, it's primarily progressive elected officials that have basically denied any of this. So that's why I write on my Substack to show the brutal reality of the streets, very uncensored, if people are willing to look, to accept the truth.
And by the way, Kevin, just to make it clear how enticing this is as an addiction, Kevin, if I gave you a dollar and said, hey, Kevin, go to a store and get enough beer to get a buzz on, could you do that with a dollar?
I don't even think, no, you can't even buy one can for a dollar. But for $1, you can get a fentanyl pill, which is 50 times stronger than heroin. $1 will get you not only the highest you've ever been, but it'll probably kill you. That's how high it will get you. I mean, that's how insanely deadly it is. And it's so shockingly cheap now, everybody is using it. I mean, it's literally like the worst thing I've ever seen. Like, I used to think heroin was bad, and then fentanyl came out of nowhere, and I was like, oh, my God.
This is worse. Kevin Dahlgren is an independent journalist reporting on homelessness, addiction, and the homeless industrial complex. He spends a lot of time on the street. We'll be back in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and we'll talk about the months of fear and Democrat hysteria amplified by the media. Let's.
The Zoom meeting you actually want to be at. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. In a moment, I want to tell you about how angry I am at the mainstream news media for not questioning this notion that is being pushed, and it's being pushed by just about everybody. All the major television stations in the Northwest, all the major Daily Dead Fish rappers have been pushing the notion why people are terrified. They're in hysteria. They're showing up at public meetings. They're so fearful. And you wonder, what's happening? Is Bigfoot coming out of the woods finally? You know, is there a tsunami on its way? No. No, what we're talking about is ICE is enforcing federal law. I think most of us would say, well, if you're hysterical about ICE enforcing federal law, let me guess, you're not legally in America, in which case, I don't care. If you're fearful because you're a criminal and you're breaking the law and you're worried that the sheriff has finally come to town and it's a new sheriff, not President Otto Penn, and you're saying, why, they might come in and force the law on me. Yes, they might. And God bless them for doing so. But before I get to that, let's talk to Elizabeth, who's calling in from Kent, listening on our Radio Northwest affiliate, KVI. Elizabeth, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Lars. So forgive me if I didn't hear your whole subject about Metro.
I will not forgive you for that, Elizabeth. I expect you to listen to every minute of every show I do without fail. Assure me that you're going to do that from this point forward.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So I agree with part of, and I'm going to use Metro because I live in the Puget Sound area. I don't know what other cities call their transit. But here we have Metro, but we also have Access. And if nobody knows what Access is used by people that are physically challenged, intellectually challenged, you know, they may be blind, you know, health reasons or what have you, epilepsy, seizures, that need to use this, or elderly.
They need to get to the doctor, they need to go shopping, they need to get their groceries, things like that, right?
Yes. And also, you know, Access provides a way for these people to, you know, have jobs that may be high functioning, be able to have their independence and have a purpose in life.
Yep.
And, you know, they use these vehicles, you know, to do their Special Olympic activities, et cetera. So what my fear is, I agree, Metro is, you know, I don't like Metro. I think it's just a waste of money.
How about Sound Transit? Are you a fan of unsound transit?
No.
Can I tell you something, Elizabeth? I only took a little bit of economics, but there was a great idea, and I think it's called substitute goods. What it means is that if you say, I can't afford chicken tonight, I think I'll go with pasta. All right. So it's a substitute. You're saying,
right.
And it also, there's also one, and I can't remember the name of the concept. It means if you say, this weekend, I'm going to go to a concert. And you spend some money. And since you don't have unlimited money, and I don't either, you say, if I'm going to go to the concert, then I can't go to the movies. Right? That's pretty
absolutely
simple. Right?
Yep.
Now,
yep.
Let me point out to you, do you think there's enough access for the people who need it?
No.
Okay.
Stop
with no, and let me tell you where this is the giant ripoff. Because the numbers you might have missed, but I'll repeat them. Randall O'Toole is one of the biggest and best transit experts in all of America. He gets paid by cities to come in and say, hey, we're all screwed up here. Will you straighten us out? And what he said was, and he shocked me because I thought we were using, you know what per capita numbers are? You say so much per capita. So we have a lot more people today than we did in 1965, right?
Yes.
So you'd expect some numbers to go up just because the population got bigger. There were 8 billion people a year riding transit in 1965. Now, since then, we have spent $2.5 trillion nationwide on transit. Where do you suppose that number 8 trillion went from the 1965 number of 8 trillion? Where is it today?
I have no clue.
7 trillion. So imagine this. You say, hold on, there were 8 trillion rides given in a given year. You know, so that's number of Americans who rode it every day or every week or whatever. There were 8 trillion rides given by public transit in 1965. Today, only 7 trillion rides in a given year in the United States. How much have we spent between then and now? $2.5 trillion, most of it on capital costs, things like buying buses, buying trains, buying all the other stuff that makes a transit system work. Now, Elizabeth, in any other part of your life, would you spend a gigantic amount of money on something you do, and after spending the gigantic amount of money, you're doing less of it than you were before you spent the money? Does that make sense?
No, but that's what our government does all the time.
Well, it does, and here's where the theft comes. Because, Elizabeth, I understand what you're saying about access. Access sounds like a great service, and it serves a population that probably can't afford to do it another way. Although, I might be tempted to say, if you figure out where people are going and how often and all that, would access better be provided by a private provider like Lyft or Uber? And I have no financial interest in either company. I'm not trying to pimp them out. But if
oh, no,
you said
they're actually better because I'm an in-home caregiver for three intellectually challenged men.
Yeah.
And Access and Taxi, sometimes Access can't, they're low staffed or they don't have enough buses for a particular event or what have you. Or day, or time of day. And so they'll sometimes, we'll use a taxi, not Uber or anything like that, but usually a taxi. Taxi is always on time, and taxi always gets them to point A to point B better than even the Access bus.
Yes, because they can do door-to-door, right? And I would imagine that
Access,
Uber, and I would...
Access does do door to door, but you have other people in Access.
Oh, I see.
Longer, yeah. And with Access, you have to give them. You can only schedule a ride two ways. One, the time they have to be there. So, like my guy, he has to be there at 8:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
They actually say, okay, we'll pick him up at 5:50 in the morning.
Holy cow! So he's going to sit in a vehicle
crazy.
For 2 hours. Now, if you called Uber or Lyft and said, hey, can you pick him up? It's a half-hour trip. Pick him up 40 minutes before his appointment and take him right to his appointment. They would. And what I'm curious about is, but here's the point I was making about transit. If we're spending gigantic sums of money, I mean, Sound Transit, among others, spends billions of dollars on lines that only go from A to B. They can't move once they put the tracks down.
Correct.
They can't change it.
Yep.
So every time they spend a billion on that, it's a billion they don't have to spend on access. Or maybe subsidize. What if you gave all those disabled people and said, listen, when you need to get a ride, we've arranged a deal. We pay Uber or Lyft a certain amount of money and you get a half price ride. And all you have to do is call them or, you know, get online and say, okay, I need, or your caregiver gets online and says, my client needs to go to the doctor at this time on Friday morning, pick him up 45 minutes early and take him right to the doctor. And then we want to arrange for a ride to get him home when he needs to get home.
Right.
When you spend these massive sums, $2.5 trillion over the last 50 years, and you have fewer people riding transit, do you know who's happy about that? Politicians who like to have press conferences in front of new Sound Transit. And Elizabeth, a lot of big construction companies in Seattle and Portland that say, boy, when we build one of them $7 billion Sound Transit lines, over half of that is labor, and we make money like nobody's business. Elizabeth, thanks so much. I appreciate the call. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Get enough, Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And as you know, the U.S. Supreme Court has heard the arguments in favor and opposed to the idea of President Trump using tariffs to negotiate some of the great trade deals that he's managed to negotiate. And I might point out that Trump is on quite a win streak right now. 19 wins in just, what is it, 10 months as president of the United States. 19 wins before the U.S. Supreme Court. So I thought we'd check in with Ryan Young. He's not a legal expert. He's a senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Ryan, welcome back.
How you doing, Lars?
I'm doing pretty well. So help me roll this out, because it sounds like a number of the justices on the Supreme Court, perhaps a majority of them, seem to agree that the president went beyond his powers under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, the IEPA, I guess they call it, which gives him the authority to impose the tariffs. And, of course, the opponents of Donald Trump, and that's basically everybody on the left, says, no, he doesn't have the authority. Does it sound as though maybe the Supreme Court's going to agree with them and then say, you know, you've got to undo all of this and hand the money back?
I think so. Sounds like Justice Alito is going to side with Trump, but I wouldn't be surprised to see a 7-2 or 8-1 decision striking down these tariffs. It's not going to put an end to President Trump's tariffs. He has plenty of other statutes to which he can turn. But the IEEPA Emergency Powers Bill nowhere mentions the word tariffs. And that's kind of a big deal. So I would expect a narrow ruling at least.
What does it give him the authority to do? And could tariffs be read into that, saying the president can act as he needs to in an emergency? Does it exclude tariffs as one of his tools, or does it just not mention which tools he's allowed to use?
It's fake. It does not mention the word tariffs or taxes at all, which is in part because Congress has the power of the purse. But it also specifies limits on what counts as an emergency. In this case, the president declared trade deficits as a national emergency. But that statute says the emergency has to be unusual, and it also has to be urgent. And we've run a trade deficit every year since 1976, but economically the country's better off by pretty much any measure. Compare health care, automobiles, or the quality of housing now compared to 50 years ago. If trade deficits have done any harm, it's not really slowed down the march of progress. And so they're not unusual, and it's not an urgent emergency. And one thing the administration's lawyer admitted, that if the court allows the Trump administration to declare a specious emergency, he even said in court, yeah, a future Democratic administration can use the same strategy to declare a climate change emergency and enact all kinds of essentially unlimited policies without a check and a balance from Congress.
Oh, no, they lost Bill Gates on that one last week. So, you know, I think that one's over. I think they may be putting that one in the rearview mirror. But let me ask you this, Ryan. Was there a better tool that Trump could have turned to that would have given him the authority to impose tariffs and say to countries, we want fair trade deals, and if not, I'm gonna hit you with tariffs? Because I wonder two questions. One, at that point, if this is overruled by the Supreme Court, does Trump have to take all the monies that have been collected in tariffs and hand them back to the countries? And question two is, do those countries then say, well, we made this new trade deal with you on the basis that you were going to punish us with tariffs or else, as the or else, except now you don't have tariffs, so guess what? We want to throw the trade deal out. What happens to those trade deals that were negotiated?
The administration has already begun pivoting to other statutes. There are another four or five or six or seven statutes that the administration could turn to. Those steel and aluminum and copper tariffs, those are under a different bit of trade legislation from the 1960s. The China tariffs, those are from a bill from 1974. So he has several other tools to which he can turn. And as far as are they going to unwind some of the IEEPA tariffs, and would that affect trade deals? Yes, and yes, they would have to issue refunds. The court doesn't care about that, though. The question they're concerned with is this a good policy or is this a feasible policy? The only question the Supreme Court is concerned with is this constitutional or not? And my guess is no, but the administration will just, if it made a mess, it will have to clean it up. It can be done. And if the administration wants to continue to pursue tariffs and those kinds of trade deals, it has other tools to do so. It likes the emergency powers bill because it's fast and frictionless. Those other statutes have time limits. They require reports and in some cases on how high the tariffs can go, but they're still there and they're constitutional.
Okay. I guess I got but the money would have to be handed back. And I'm with you. I don't want the Supreme Court deciding we shouldn't do this. It'll cause all this disruption. I think they should just look and say it is constitutional or it's not. He does have the authority or he doesn't. But as you said, he's got other tools. Are those tools just as good and just as flexible?
We'll see. There was a court challenge against those metal tariffs. Those are under a national security statute from 1962. That court challenge failed, but that was before the major questions doctrine and the non-delegation doctrine came into effect. And since we're talking about the largest peacetime tax increase in American history, it qualifies as a major question, so it might be vulnerable to a new challenge. And the non-delegation says, how much of its taxing authority can Congress give away to the president? We're settling that question right now, and I don't know how that would come down in court, but some of these statutes are vulnerable to another legal challenge, and others are a little more robust.
Is this the kind of decision that the Supreme Court's going to say you got to wait till June, or are they going to actually pop out a decision on this fairly quickly, given that I guess you could imagine more damage if you've taken $350 billion from South Korea and you got to give it back? Do they wait till June to issue this one like they do with a lot of big ones?
This should be a quick verdict in Supreme Court Kremlinology. They bundled this case with another similar case. And when they do that, that's usually a sign that they want to issue a verdict quickly, probably for exactly the reasons that you described. So I would expect a verdict by the end of the year. And the refunds, South Korea's not paying the tariffs, Americans are. So the refunds would go to Americans.
And how does that work?
If you import something from South Korea, the person who literally writes the check to U.S. Customs and Border Patrol would be either your company that does the importing,
right,
or you yourself. And then it gets passed along down the chain through the consumer. So Americans pay for the tariffs. Foreigners do not.
So in other words, when the tariffs are, or when, if the repayment had to happen, there's just going to be what, hundreds of thousands or millions of checks going out to all these different entities that had to pay the tariff?
Yeah, and it is going to be a mess. The administration has a point there, but, you know, if they did something that's unconstitutional, that is much more important than some kind of mess that the administration should not have created in the first place.
Does this blow a hole in the ability of Donald Trump to negotiate more trade deals? Because you know he wants to do more of them, and frankly, I want to see him do more of them. I think America's been getting ripped off for a long, long time.
It doesn't, because he has those other statutes, and more importantly, in a country founded on the separation of powers, he can work with Congress anytime he wants. Congress can pass a bill enacting all of those tariffs today. So if he's willing to work with Congress and respect the separation of powers, there's essentially no limit to what he can do.
Wow. So, and this may be one of the losses he suffers, although, like I said, he's got a big string of wins. Does it weaken his ability to go to other countries and say, I'd like another trade deal? And they say, we saw how that last one worked out. Your tariffs fell apart, and no, we're not going to bargain. Do you see that happening?
I don't think it weakens his hand very much at all, because he has those other statutes. He has Congress, and he's obviously determined on the tariff issue. He's not going to change his mind about them as a negotiating tool, and other countries know this. So I don't think it'll affect too much in the long run.
Very good. Ryan, thank you very much. I appreciate the time, and we appreciate your insights for the program.
Thank you.
That is Ryan Young. He's a senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis.
talk@LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails on this Conspiracy Theory Thursday. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com. For an instant offer to sell your home immediately, no showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date, go to NickShivers.com for details. Let me go first to Roger, who's listening on the Radio Northwest Network in Medford. Hey, Roger, what's on your mind today?
What's up, my man, Lars? Hey, so I've been thinking about the homeless problem. Nobody's got an answer for it, nothing. So,
oh, I do.
Here's my idea. Well, I know me and you do. So we have concentration camps all over the United States.
we do?
You were talking about billions of dollars that, well, through Biden, that we're supposed to have had.
Where are the anyway, you gotta help me.
Know.
Help me up to date.
Well,
where are the concentration camps?
I don't know. But back when Biden was in, you were seeing camps with with plastic coffins, and that was going around the internet. Now, I could be wrong, okay? So what if there ain't? I don't want them to be a concentration camp anyway. I want to build places that are nice, and there's no drugs, and you've been arrested so many times for drugs. You have to go to this place, and you don't get out until you can perform a job skill. They could be, you know, the billions and billions of dollars that we're spending.
You're going to sentence people to these camps?
Well, there's got to be something else we can do. No,
but Roger, how do you go about forcing American citizens to go to, well, I mean, unless it's prison. If you commit a crime, you get sent to prison. You're talking about, like, prison light?
No. What I'm talking about, if you've, because I have a kid that's addicted to drugs. I don't even know where she is. She's been to jail, I don't know how many times. They just release her. I'll bet you 50 times. If they would have put her in jail, her husband went to prison. He's all better. He's all fixed. She's still not. They never put a girl in prison. So I'm not saying, if you get so many failure to appears, you have to take this program.
Do you have the legal authority to do that?
Well, they offer you prison time. I worked in the jail system. They offer you prison time or take the program, the drug program.
That's actually the old drug court. But you know why that's gone away, yeah. Roger? Oregon passed Measure 110. Yeah. It legalized hard drugs. They've now come back from that to a very, very light punishment where nobody gets prosecuted for drugs. So it's functionally, it's the same thing. It's drug legalization. And at that point, Roger, to do your plan, you'd have to convince lawmakers in Salem and probably lawmakers in Olympia as well to pass a new law that goes right back to the same old system, which worked because people went into treatment if they had the threat of a felony conviction. But interesting idea. Thanks for the call, Roger. Let's go to Margaret. Hey, Margaret, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, what's on my mind is this ridership issue and how few people are riding the buses that are crossing the I-5 bridge today. There's fewer riders today than there were 20 years ago.
True.
And IBR, the consultant group that is advocating for light rail, it is completely unjustified. And the federal funding for the transit component requires that it be justifiable.
Yeah, based
it's
on the ridership.
Absolutely not, given the current ridership numbers.
And you know what TriMet routinely does? They promise the federal transportation agencies, the sun, moon, and stars, and say, well, we'll have tens of thousands of people riding that thing. And then when they don't, nobody calls them on it. Margaret, that's what happens.
Yeah, they're talking about there's going to be 29,000 people riding it in the future.
That's what they claim.
But today it's only 600 because a few people know that it's a single route. It's the Route 60, a single route that they're using that they say the 600 people a day, and that's over 19 hours. That's both directions.
Yep.
So there's
And you're right about all that, but Margaret, can I point something out to you? Do you know who the biggest advocate on the north side of the Columbia River is for Interstate Bridge Light Rail?
Well, the Vancouver mayor is very...
Ann McInerney Ogle. Do you know what voters did on Monday?
Council.
Do you know what Monday? You know what voters did on Monday or Tuesday?
Well, unfortunately, this type of thing is not talked about in the mainstream media.
That's true.
So
we talk about it on this show a lot.
Who's pushing it, why they're pushing it. Nobody really knows.
Every time I've talked about that stupid...
I'm sorry?
Every time I've talked about that stupid bridge in the last 6 years, I've mentioned Ann McInerney Ogle. She's been on the show once. She won't come back on. And she continues to press for it. But I guess what I'd ask Ann is, or Ms. Margaret, Ann McInerney Ogle is the biggest proponent of it. There is no sense to what she's suggesting, but the voters just reelected her. And you would think if the voters said, no, we're dead set against that, this is one of her signature issues, we're not going to vote her back in. They just voted her back in on Tuesday. So how should I take that message?
Well, I think voters are uninformed. I think voters should also know that Sue Marshall, the chair of the Clark County Council, is another aggressive pusher of this system.
I totally agree with you. But, Margaret, at this point, it sounds like they're forging ahead without the money and without the ridership.
The Lars Larson Show.
It's so in exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. You know, I don't think I can pick another time in my entire career when the police have acted as politically as they do. And I think if you've followed this show, you know that for decades, I've been a supporter of the police because they enforce the law. But then when the police, answering to their political masters, and that includes mayors and city councils, begin to act in a political fashion, that is, if you're a conservative, you're going to feel the full weight of the law come down on top of your head like a ton of bricks. And if you're a liberal, like, say, Antifa terrorists or BLM or the like, then you're not going to see the full weight of the law come down on top of you. At that point, I can't support what they're doing. And I think this is a particular case where the police acted based on politics and not based on the law. Angus Lee is an attorney in Washington State. He now represents Nick Sorter, who's a journalist. Also, he's on social media. I don't know Mr. Sorter, but I've looked at his stuff on social media a lot. And when he began covering what was going on at the ICE headquarters in the So What district, the South Waterfront district of Portland, and I thought he went down there to cover what was going on, and he got assaulted, and then the police arrested the person who got assaulted and not the people who assaulted him. Now, if I got any of that wrong, I'm sure that Angus Lee will be happy to correct me. Angus, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to be here. And as usual, you did your homework. You know what you're talking about, and everything you just said was completely accurate.
Do you have some sense of why the police acted politically and took Nick Sorter, your client, into custody, and then had to spend an hour figuring out, well, what, now that we've got him, what are we going to charge him with? We've got to figure out some law he broke so we can justify arresting him. Is that true?
That's accurate. And what's going on here is this case is a prime example of a long-standing pattern and practice of biased policing against conservatives and in favor of people like Antifa that goes back at least a decade in Portland.
And why? What's driving this? It's not the individual actions of police chiefs. It's got to be coming from their bosses, isn't it?
Yes, it's a pattern of influence from elected officials, be it city council, current mayors, former mayors, and, you know, keeping in mind that the former mayor used to be the head of the police department officially. But there's been a concerted effort by elected officials above the line officers to pressure the police department to only enforce the law against political opponents so that people could not come and speak freely in Portland about what was wrong. And that actually benefited people like Mayor Ted Wheeler because they didn't want people publicly saying what he was doing wrong. And so when Antifa would tack Wheeler's critics, then he would want the police to look the other way. And they essentially would. But then they'd also use it as an opportunity to arrest the critics of Antifa and the like.
So you saw people like the Proud Boys get arrested or attacked or charged. You saw people like Mike Strickland, who was defending himself as he was set upon by a bunch of protesters, not necessarily Antifa in those days, but maybe BLM or their allies. And you see the guy defending himself get arrested. It sounds a lot like what happened to Nick Sorter the other night, although no gun involved in Sorter's case.
Yeah, and in the last few weeks since his arrest, we have been doing a detailed review of this bias policing in Portland, and we've prepared a 22-page historical memo that we sent to the Department of Justice, to Pam Bondi, to Armeet Dhillon, asking them to do two things. Basically, we want them to look into the city of Portland for pattern and practice civil rights violations and seek injunctive relief, effectively get a consent decree if need be, to go in against the police department and dig into this the way only the Attorney General of the United States can, and say, we're going to put an end to this. That's primarily what we've done. They've received that memo, and our understanding is they're appreciative and they're looking into it, because they, out in D.C., I don't think they have an idea of the historical problem in Portland.
Well, and in fact, Angus, you know what this reminds me of, even though this happened before I was born? But if you'd had a bunch of civil rights activists show up in Selma, Alabama, and all of a sudden the police show up and the activists get arrested, but if the locals show up who don't like the civil rights activists, in that case it was a black-white issue, and they show up with axe handles and everything else, nothing they do sends them to jail or gets them cited, but the activists get cited. It sounds like exactly that kind of situation, the kind of thing that most of the liberal progressives in Portland probably look back in history and say, oh, that was terrible back then, you know, when civil rights protesters couldn't even protest without worrying about getting their head busted, except now we've got it just in a slightly different direction.
Yeah, it's the exact same dynamic, and it's the old phrase about what the tyrant says, for my friends, anything, for my enemies, the law. And that's exactly what's been happening. And there's numerous examples. I mean, one of the prime examples in 2020 was Joey Gibson did a protest in front of an Antifa headquarters, and he was assaulted and pepper sprayed and kicked. And what did the Portland police do? With pressure from the mayor specifically, and really with the intent of suppressing political speech, they arrested and prosecuted the victim once again. And even when they had absolute knowledge of who had assaulted him, they refused to take any action. So really, we need the Attorney General's office to address this at a federal level.
And do you think that Armeet Dhillon will take this one on and come in and take a hard look at what's going on here?
Well, we're putting the memo out to the public, and we're going to make sure that she's aware of it. And we're certainly asking anyone on social media who sees that to encourage her to do so. And, you know, it's no secret that this administration is very responsive to people online expressing their views, which is a really wonderful thing. And so it's really helpful when people do that. And I think they will, because the case is really strong for a pattern and practice violation. And 34 U.S. Code 12601 gives the Attorney General clear authority to step in and take action against the Portland Police Department and the Portland City of Portland in a case like this.
Look, all I want to see, Angus, is I want to see that if they're going to enforce the law strictly against people like Nick Sorter, or Mike Strickland, or Joey Gibson, and you're right about that case, we covered that one as well, then they should do just the same with everybody from Antifa, especially when Antifa has been regularly engaging in activity that could easily bring disorderly conduct, malicious mischief, assault, assault with weapons, things like that. And yet the Portland police play hands off with BLM, with Antifa terrorists, they play hands off. And then they say, but if a conservative shows up, boy, they are going to get the full weight of the law. That is Angus Lee. He's an attorney in Washington State. He now represents journalist Nick Sorter that you see on social media. Again, Nick hasn't even been on the show, so I don't know the guy, but I'll tell you what. If they're going to come down on him and charge him with a crime and ignore the people who assaulted him, that is not policing. That is politics. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Are you 34?
Right on the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, your Thanksgiving Day table, at least in terms of the food on top of it, is going to cost about 3% less this year than last year. I understand that all of us have complained about grocery prices. Believe me, I go shopping with Tina, and I'm not just there to drive the car and carry the heavy bags. Tina and I shop together. It's appalling how much food costs. And yet, is Donald Trump's economy delivering the feast, or is it just a temporary holiday miracle? I can give you a few examples, and let me give you just a couple of those. The average Thanksgiving Day dinner will be about 3% cheaper than last year. Now, does that reverse the 4 years of Joe Biden where prices went up about 25 or 30%? It does not. But let me give you a couple of specific examples. Dinner rolls down 22%, frozen vegetables down 15%, things like turkey stuffing, gravy mix, fresh cranberries, and pumpkin pies all cost less. Walmart puts together a Thanksgiving meal. Their Thanksgiving meal, and it's the same meal every year, but how much does it cost? Well, this year, 25% less than last year, and the lowest turkey price since 2019. That one feeds 10 people and works out to about $4 a person. At Lidell's, which is more of an East Coast chain, Thanksgiving meal costs $10 less than last year. Aldi's is about $7 less than last year, the lowest price since 2019. Bunch of East Coast ones, Schnucks. I'd never even heard of Schnucks. Apparently, they're a big supermarket chain in the Midwest. They are now selling frozen turkeys at the lowest price in more than 15 years. So, have some things gone up? Yep. Have other things gone down? And is Thanksgiving cheaper this year? I would have to say that it is. Here, calls now. Let's start with Weldon. Hey, Weldon, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. I know that you know that we've been talking about homeless issues and how many billions billions of dollars that America's been spending on that problem and without seeming to solve it. What's on your mind?
Well, Roger had an idea of drug compounds. So he's forgetting one clear element that needs to be done, voluntary participation. Well, here's the deal. You have the drug compounds. They don't have to be nice, but it's free drugs and free food all you want. And you bring your tent, welcome in. There's only two exits, a morgue and treatment. Now, I will submit to you right now that there are two such compounds. And
now,
that
now,
is
just so,
Seattle,
Weldon, I got to let everyone.
That is
hey,
Seattle
Weldon, Weldon, Weldon.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I'm having a conversation with you, I have to remember there are a lot of other people who didn't hear the earlier caller saying that his idea was to put homeless people in America in concentration camps, which he assumes came about during the Biden administration. I don't think any such thing was built.
No, but, no, they don't.
No, but you're saying, why don't we say this to the homeless? You have the choice. Come out to this camp. Yeah. You'll get free food and free drugs, and then the only way to exit is either the morgue or treatment. And that's so you're making it all voluntary. People voluntarily get on the bus, and then they come out for the free food and the free drugs, and then they can either go to treatment or they can go to the morgue, right?
Yeah. But I wanted to submit to you that we already have those two camps, and they are Seattle and Portland. The only difference is that we're trapped in there with them, and we got to deal with the crime and walk over the dead bodies.
Sadly, I think you're right. And this is the sad thing, that we've got a great country here that has seems to have completely ignored this problem. And here's what's worse about it. And I would say, I know that a lot of people don't like it when I point out the politics of a situation. But I think that what has happened is Democrats and liberals have seized on the homeless problem, and they've said, here is an excuse for us to go to the taxpayers and say, do you want us to deal with the homeless? And most people, right or left, would say, yeah, will you do something about that? And they then say, well, we want to spend a gigantic amount of money. I mean, Los Angeles is spending billions. New York is spending billions. Other big cities are spending portions of $1 billion every year. And you say, well, what are you getting done? Well, we've got all these programs. We've got all these people who head up these non-governmental organizations who, by the way, when you send money to a government, you can at least walk in and say, I want to see the budget where you're sending the money. If you send money to an NGO, a non-governmental organization, the minute those dollars disappear into the NGO, they become completely opaque. You can't see what they're doing with the money. And I know what they're doing with the money. The money is going into these NGOs. It is funding political organizations that work on behalf of the Democrat Party. Now, if somebody wants to say, well, both sides do it, because, Weldon, there is an inclination by people in every situation to say, well, you've got to look at both sides, or both sides do it. That is the purest hogwash, and I hear it all the time. I mean, people will literally make the argument, you know, there's something that, you know, both sides are benefiting. Show me a Republican or conservative organization that gets its funding as a result of money given to a nonprofit NGO that works with the homeless. I don't know of a single one. Do you?
It's like a snake eating its tail. The Democrats are never going to solve this problem, because if they solve the problem, the money stops flowing in.
Yep, it sure does.
So it's a beast, and it's going to take a sense of brutality and maybe non-funding. Cut all the funding off to kill this beast.
Do you know, Weldon, one of my favorite organizations to deal with this is Salvation Army and Union Gospel Mission, that have operations all across the country. And you know what they have in common? I believe it's still true of Union Gospel Mission, is that they don't take a dime of government money. And you know why? Because I've talked to some of their people who run their programs, and their program is, you're drug addicted, you're living on the streets, you're sleeping in a cardboard box, you're wet, you're cold, you're sick. We will take you in, we will feed you, we will get you cleaned up. You can, you know, get a fresh suit of clothes and take a shower and get a meal. And then we want to keep you in the program for 6 months to get you as close to off drugs as we possibly can. And we're going to find you a job, and we expect you to be productive. And if they took the government money, they would be beholden to all these government rules and regs. And they've said, as attractive as the money is, they don't want anything to do with it, because they know the government doesn't want to solve this problem, and they do, and usually because of their faith beliefs.
There is no problem the government has ever solved. Why would we put this in their hands?
I think that's an excellent question. Thank you, Weldon. Let's go to Shirley. Hey, Shirley, what's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I've got an idea for the homeless people in Salem, actually all over. The government has had more than enough chance to go into these, to go to these empty buildings and put cots in there for the homeless, make rules, and like no drugs, no alcohol, unless the drugs are prescribed by a physician.
Yeah, they could, but they don't, and there's a reason they don't, and it's dual, Shirley. They will go to people living on the streets, and I'm not kidding. If you don't believe me, check it out. And they will say, we'd like you to go into a shelter. I've talked to homeless people myself and said, why don't you go to the shelters? They say, I can't smoke. I can't bring my dog. I can't sleep with my girlfriend. And people steal from you. And you say, so all the rules that would make a place a civilized place for everybody in that shelter, a lot of the so-called homeless say, I don't want to do that. I want to keep my dog. I want to sleep with my girlfriend. I want to smoke cigarettes. I want to shoot heroin. I want to take fentanyl. I want to act crazy when I want to. And I'm not going to put up with the rules, so I'm not going into the shelter. And in that case, then you're just going to have to be subject to the law. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest.
Lars Larson Show. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So if a city elects leaders whose policies conflict with federal priorities, should taxpayers all across America be required to fund a city that does that? Or does local leadership have to carry the outcome of that? I thought we'd talk about it with Corinne Clifford, who's an independent journalist and the White House Press Corps member and official spokesperson for Sat-123. Corinne, welcome to the program.
I am so grateful to be on with you tonight. I lost my voice because there's been so much news this week.
It does happen. I mean, I have laryngitis from time to time. I try to avoid it. I drink a lot of water. But all of this goes back to Donald Trump doing an interview on Sunday, and then the election of Zohran Mamdani in New York City. And Trump had famously said it's going to be hard for me as president to give a lot of money to New York, because if you have a communist running New York City, all you're going to be doing is wasting the money you're sending there. And I think he's right. I think Mamdani, if he lives up to all of his many, many promises, he wanted to act like Santa Claus, free buses, free this, free that, government-run grocery stores. He's going to run that place out of money. And I know what happens when New York City runs out of money. They turn to Washington, D.C., and Trump says, I'm not going to give him a dime. So what do you think is going to happen?
I think this is going to be so interesting, because President Trump is not going to help Mamdani or anything that he does. And so when Mamdani needs money, where is he going to go? What if he goes to Alex Soros? Alex Soros was one of the biggest funders of his campaign. My mom lives in New York City, and she voted for Mamdani. The
what?
People who live in New York City, yes. I can't even talk to her. I can't even visit her. They all want the government to give them free food, free housing, free health care. They want to live off the government.
Well, let me ask you something, Corinne, because I've always had it. I mean, look, I have to admit, I've had a job my entire life. I actually have had two jobs for about the last 35 years, and that's the way I've worked. I've never been unemployed. And if I were unemployed at 8 o'clock in the morning, I tried to have a job by 5 o'clock that night. I haven't been on food stamps or welfare, and I didn't come from a wealthy family. I had a mom who was a public health nurse and a dad who was a park ranger, both for state and federal agencies. So we never had any money, but I wasn't unhappy. But I've never thought about living on somebody else. Where do they think this free stuff is being paid for? Who do they think is paying for it? Has your mom ever told you where the money is supposed to come
from? Exactly. I'm going to ask her, but the people in New York City like to have the free trains. They like to have the food. I think Mamdani is lying. I think he just used that as a campaign promise to get elected. But also, you know, if it happens, where are they going to get the money from? The taxes are already out of control in New York City, and New York City's already in debt. Maybe they'll get the money from the fact that the fire chief just quit in New York City, and the police chief will probably quit too. Maybe they'll stop having police because Mamdani will convince his followers that they can police themselves. So maybe they can take those budgets. I don't know.
Because I'll tell you what I wonder is if New York City under Mamdani is going to end up a lot like the Chop Zone or the Chaz Zone in Seattle, you know, a number of years ago, when they took over an entire section of the city, burned the police precinct, and said, we're taking control. I think those were the roots of Antifa and to some extent BLM. And what happened? As soon as they took over control, they decided, and we have to have our own police force, only they were people who were armed and were dangerous, but they weren't following any laws. There were no courts. There was no due process. There was no nothing. It was basically just whoever's got the guns is in charge.
I mean, that's basically how New York City has become under Eric Adams. So I think we've got a bigger problem going on here, because if New York City does allow Mamdani to actually implement what he said during his campaign, That's going to be a big problem. That could be a soft civil war. I mean, people do not want Mamdani to be able to take over New York City. Half the people are going to leave. Most people that I know are leaving New York City right now, moving to Florida.
Well, I wonder, I'm talking to Corinne Clifford, who's an independent journalist and part of the White House Press Corps and official spokesperson for sat123.com. I wonder if what's going to happen is all the people who have some kind of financial resources, not necessarily rich, but at least self-sufficient, they're going to say, we're getting out of here, because we know who they're going to come after to pay the bill. And the people who can't afford to leave are going to be the ones who most likely voted for Mamdani and want all the free stuff because they don't have anything. They're going to be left sitting in the Big Apple wondering, well, who's going to pick up the tab now if all the productive people have left?
That is the biggest concern. And if you own a business in New York City, it could be confiscated under this type of socialism, communism. So I wouldn't be in New York City, and I would not stay there. The people that I know who are in New York City right now, as I said before, are people who are retired, people who are not trying to make money. Everyone I know who used to make money in New York City already left. They moved to Greenwich, Connecticut, or they moved to Florida. People have already left New York City. So now there's going to be a bigger reason to leave New York City. But I'm going to go to New York City because I want to cover Mondami. I want to get his official press pass. I think it's going to be hilarious what he says to the press and to the public. I think that's going to be the most entertaining experience I've ever had.
I mean, see, Corinne, one of the things I've always loved doing with my audience is I say, look, I don't do higher math, but I can do regular math. And when people come out like Mamdani and say, oh, I'm going to get $100 billion and I'm going to build a whole bunch of housing. And you look at the numbers and say, you're going to build housing in New York City at $500,000 a unit when the average one-bedroom apartment, if you want to buy one in New York City, is $1.3 million. How does that math work out? I mean, you don't have to be into higher finance or anything else to say, I don't think those numbers add up. And I think that's what he's going to find out, except maybe he thinks it'll be a few years before everybody figures out his housing plan is completely bankrupt. And by then they can toss him out.
I mean, this is going to be truly exciting, and I hope that I can get the press pass to cover what he does, because it's like what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now with the U.S. federal government shutdown, seeing how Nancy Pelosi's behaving, seeing how Hakeem Jeffries is behaving, seeing Chuck Schumer and what he says to me is entertaining. As a journalist, I'm laughing at them because they're making stuff up, just like Mondami made stuff up in order to win this election.
Well, and I wonder if all those people are going to have some buyer's remorse about the time he actually starts to implement some of these policies. Because if you take him seriously, and Corinne, early on, months ago, one of the first things we talked about with Mamdani was his plan to have government grocery stores. And he say, well, how would that be better? And they say, well, they'd sell at food for less money than the current grocery stores do, except he simultaneously promised to have a $30 minimum wage. And I'm wondering, the only way I know of for a government-run grocery store to be cheaper than the private sector and also pay its employees 30 bucks an hour is if you just subsidize the daylights out of it. In other words, it's cheaper because somebody else is paying the bill. The problem is the somebody else's are heading for the exit door.
I think he said whatever he had to say in order to win this election, and I think he's going to have a huge wake-up call when he realizes that he doesn't have the money to finance this, but I don't think he even cares. He's from Uganda. He's not American. He doesn't care about our U.S. Constitution. He doesn't care about free market capitalism, and he doesn't care about the American way and the American dream. So we have a problem because we cannot turn into the United Kingdom. We cannot have crazy, and I hate to say this because I love Muslim people, but we can't have these crazy Shia Muslim mayors who don't care about the American way of life and our U.S. Constitution.
No, we can't. Corinne, thanks very much. I know that took a lot out of your voice. That's Corinne Clifford. She is an independent journalist and part of the White House Press Corps. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Northwest states with honestly.
Political climate. He's the steamroller. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. In our X poll today, is it now embarrassing for women to have boyfriends? I would imagine this is mostly liberal women, but Vogue magazine now says that women are embarrassed to admit they have boyfriends. According to Vogue, which is viewed as a fashion Bible by some, the Daily Mail says that having a man in your life is seen as cringe and culturally loserish, which is prompting women, on social media at least, to hide evidence that they have a boyfriend. One article done by Shante Joseph says there are many reasons that women want to keep their romances secret, as she admitted to muting her own contacts in social media posts as soon as they mentioned that she has a boyfriend. And one influencer said she lost hundreds of followers when she posted about her relationship. And get this, one interviewee said she had a relationship with a man for 12 years and never admitted it to her digital friends. crazy. Is it now embarrassing for women to have boyfriends? I'd say no, but I'm a traditional person. And one of the people who commented said, why does having a boyfriend make you feel Republican? Is that a bad thing? Anyway, you can find the question on X at Lars Larson Show and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let me start with Ernest. Hey, Ernest, welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. What's on your mind?
Yes, I would like to talk about racism. Racism is, and the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court shut down affirmative action and a lot, and they could shoot down the voters' right voting for people in Louisiana. And I think that the racism that we face today is so subtle. I'm 70 years old, and I can surely remember some of the times when it was really rough, and those times are still here. It's just in a more subtle way. And
so when you said, Ernest, when you said they shot down voters' rights in Louisiana, are you talking about the redistricting question that came to the courts?
Absolutely. It hasn't gone through yet, but I'm just anticipating that it probably will.
Ernest, let me ask you a question about that. One side wants to draw congressional districts, not just based on dividing up a state, which they have to redo every 10 years when the census comes out, but they want to redraw the districts so you have a black district or a Latino district rather than a mix of Americans. Should we be drawing those district lines based on people's skin color or not? I would say not.
Well, I think so, because you have to remember, you hear people talk about the race, you know, the race card. People are playing the race card. You have to remember, the race card is the only thing that African-American people have.
I think that's hogwash. Ernest, come on. The only thing you have you
everything
ever...
Everything else been taken away from them.
Have you... Hold on, Ernest, have you ever read or listened to Thomas Sowell? Or any of the other black conservatives who point out what you had taken away from you in today's world?
Well, it goes back, and I'm going to tell you. Can I ask you what your nationality, if it's all right, can I ask you what your nationality is? You don't have to tell me.
I'm an American.
I know, but what is your heritage?
Oh, okay. Well, I was born in Taiwan. My mom was English. She's passed away. My dad was of Swedish extraction. So, and am I 6 feet tall with blonde eyes or blonde hair and blue eyes?
No, I'm not. That's not what I was going to ask you.
Okay.
You know a lot of that tradition through your parents, even though they're gone. There's still a lot of that tradition that you, just like an Hispanic person, they know Hispanic. They know beans and rice. An African American is the only person in this country that we don't have nothing. We're like walking around lost with our heads.
Why can't you just be American?
Because we have no tradition. You know what our tradition is? Whatever somebody else's is.
No, but hold on, Ernest. That's not a requirement of you. I mean, there are plenty of black Americans who've traced back to where they came from. And if they say, well, my family originally came from here, or originally came from there, there's nothing. And in fact, with DNA, they can actually say, you might have come from this region, just like my DNA suggests I've got some Irish in me as well as Swedish. Does anything prevent you from doing that today?
But you're still missing the point. The point is that even though you can trace back there your tradition, your heritage, just like, let me just finish it now. An Hispanic person, even if they could trace back, let's say they couldn't speak Hispanic. Let's say they didn't eat beans and rice. But they could trace back, let's just say a Puerto Rican come from Puerto Rico. They can trace back there. But they would lose still the fact that they are able to speak Spanish and able to eat beans and rice. All of that's lost, just like you have in
you can't you could came, not go you, back and find the traditional foods from your country of origin.
No, it's all been gone. It's all been colonized. It's all been gone. We are the only people in this country who's walking around like a person with his head cut off, trying to find out who we are. What do we connect to? We don't connect to nothing. An Italian connects to Italian. They connect to the pasta. They connect to the beans.
A lot of this has to do with food. At least it sounds that way anyway. And frankly, I do like smorgasbord. That's Swedish. I'm not exactly a fan of gravlax and meatballs, but there you go. But I do have that heritage if I actually want it. Yeah, Ernest, thanks for the call. You got the Lars Larson
Show. The Lars Larson Show.